Judiciary Committee is called to order. Chair recognizes the quorum. Members, we have multiple bills on our calendar today. These are extra inning bills, meaning they were items generally that were found to have to come before judiciary based on data practices or civil law provisions, and so it was posted on the agenda that we're only hearing these bills for limited purposes as they pertain to the articles that are noticed in the agenda that was put out. They got to come here, so we're going to deal with it and talk about those data practices or civil law provisions, and then send them on either modified or not. The first order of business is the minutes of March 28th. Do I have a motion? Okay, Representative Noor moves the motion of the minutes of March 28th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The first bill that we have up is House File 2051. Representative Elkins is here, right? Is Representative Elkins here? Well, maybe we're not hearing that bill. Okay. Let's just move on. Representative 1140, House File 1146, Representative Dean. Is Representative Dean here? You guys all wanted these bills heard desperately, and then they show up. Yeah, let's get Representative Kosnick up here. Come on up, Representative Kosnick. House File 285, Department of Human Services and Metropolitan Council, data sharing for transportation purposes. What's the motion on this? Okay, the motion, the chair will move that House File 285 be re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Kosnick, to your bill.
Thank you.
Oh, wait a second. We're only hearing, what portion of this are we hearing? The scope of our jurisdiction involves data practices lines 1.16 to 2.2. And you have an author's amendment. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
A1, to get the bill in the shape the author so desires. Is there any discussion? Good. Representative Johnson moves it. A little out of order what we're how we're doing this, but any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Your bill is amended by the A1. Go ahead to your bill as amended, Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is a portion of a bill that we worked on quite extensively last biennium. And what it was started with, we did a working group with the Metropolitan Council on metro mobility issues. One of the recommendations from a task force that we did was to allow the Met Council to check for eligibility with DHS for federal reimbursement of funding for some of those rides that we're not currently receiving federal reimbursement from. And so what the bill does in terms of data practices, it gives people some opportunity to opt out of having their just the very pertinent information that's listed in the bill checked to see if there's we can get federal reimbursement for that.
Okay. Do you want Mr. Shetnin?
Mr. Shetnin from the Met Council is also here to speak to the bill.
Excellent. Go ahead, Mr. Shetnin.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to thank Representative Kosnick for carrying this bill. As he mentioned, this came out of a 2017 legislative task force asking us to figure out how we can find ways to reduce the cost of metro mobility. As folks in the Transportation Committee may know and others may know, is that the growth in that system and the demand for that service is growing at a very, very high rate. And so this task force that convened was made up of county commissioners, folks from the council, folks from the Department of Human Services, and other folks to look at ways to find ways to reduce those costs. And there were a couple of them. One of them was to look at using Lyft and Uber, which is outside of the this committee's jurisdiction. But another one was to compare data between the Department of Human Services and the Metropolitan Council between their medical assistance trips and our metro mobility trips, and to be able to compare those riders to see if we are providing rides that would be eligible for more federal reimbursement. The language before you is the language that allows us to share that data between those customer bases. I will let the committee know this is the exact language that's in the governor's bill this year. It's also the exact language that was in the omnibus bill last year, and I will stop with that and just ask for your support. This is a critical piece for us to be able to begin a program to ask for those federal reimbursements. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Koznick, I want to thank you for this bill. It is important to help, anything to help reduce costs so we can actually provide more rides for those people that need it. I do hope that you'll continue to work on this and find a way to help all of Minnesota, because it's a big issue all across the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chet. Oh, was that was common. Any other questions? No other questions. Okay, then the motion, or anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Anyone? I don't see anyone standing up and wanting to talk on it. So it's an omnibus prime. You said it was an omnibus prime, right? Okay. Then the motion by Representative, who made that? Representative Johnson made it, that House File 285 is amended, be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Koznick. And thank you for being here. You know.
Thank you for parking.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to move back to Representative Elkins. Members, House File 2051 is here specifically because of Article 4. So we'll be entertaining testimony only on Article 4 and questions only on Article 4. And you have an A2 amendment. What's this? Okay, the motion, do I have a motion for Representative Elkins' bill? It's going to be to move it to the General Register.
Sure.
Representative Constantine moves to refer this bill to the General Register. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the A2 amendment, what does this do?
Mr. Chair, this is just a technical amendment, just cleaning up the verbiage. I have John Kelly from the Department of Commerce here with me if there are any questions.
If it's technical, and you promise me it's technical, we don't need to hear anything else about it. We'll just vote on it. Are there any questions on it? Okay. All in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, your bill's amended. Go ahead on Article 4. Representative Elkins.
I'm just going to let Mr. Kelly address this.
Go ahead, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is John Kelly. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I want to thank the committee for hearing the bill. Article 4 is the Corporate Governance Model Act. This model act provides the Department of Commerce additional information on corporate governance practices on a yearly basis. Currently, the department receives corporate governance information every 3 to 5 years based on the insurance examination schedule. These models do not prescribe new corporate governance standards, but rather require tailored, confidential reporting to ensure appropriate policies and procedures of insurers, board of directors, and internal oversight are in place and effective. Currently, 27 states have passed this legislation to implement Model Act, with pending legislation in 5 states. The confidentiality language in this bill is from the NEAC Model Act, but modeled after existing sections of current Minnesota insurance law. The current bill language in the Senate also incorporates edits that were requested by the industry. The language in the bill is similar to confidentiality data practices language in 4 other areas of insurance law already in statute, specifically 60D.57 ORSA, 60D.22 Holding Company Model Act, 68.31 sub 4, and 68.1296. So while this is a new model act, the data practices language in this bill does not make any departures from existing law. The Data Practices Act, the data practices language deals with some of the most sensitive data insurers have. Having agreed upon model act language and statute ensures that the department can work quickly to see if an insurer is insolvent and take action to protect Minnesota consumers. And we appreciate the committee's support. I'll stand for any questions.
Kelly, there was some sky is falling stuff that was going to happen. You guys didn't pass this by the end of the year, right? What was going to happen to you?
Mr. Chair and members, this provision as well as the other provisions in this bill are for the Department of Commerce to maintain its accreditation with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. We need to have this bill passed into law this session, and so that they're in effect by January 1st, 2020. So that the department can maintain its accreditation. Just a brief background, NEIC accreditation is very important. It allows the states, other states, to rely on the department's review and examination of domestic insurers, reducing costs and administrative burden for Minnesota insurers. Insurance is regulated at the state level, but many insurers, including the ones that are domiciled here in Minnesota, do business across state lines, and having laws in place that are same or similar across states allows for a streamlined process, and NEIC accreditation is very important for the department.
Okay, so Ms. Kelly, if they're not accredited, other states do not have to recognize Minnesota's commerce decision, or they can't recognize it? It's just an option for them, they recognize it or not, or what?
Well, I mean, if we're not an NEIC accredited state, it makes it very hard for us to be to conduct business with other states, to do cross. We enter into a lot of examinations with other states, and we're not going to be able to be at that same level, carrying out the enforcement of insurance across state lines. We also hold many positions at the NEIC in crafting policy, and we would also not be able to continue to participate in those decisions. And the NEIC is, as states are insurance regulated at the state level, it's very important for Minnesota to maintain its leadership.
I got it. Okay. Mr. Kelly, so when was this deadline first announced?
The deadline for January 1st, 2020?
Yeah.
The NEIC has, it has accreditation standards that they give states time to enact these laws. I'm not quite sure. There's different ones in the bill. I think that states have had a few years for this particular one to go into effect, but it's kind of a now or never thing where they've given states time, and now if states do not have it in state law by 2020, they're at risk of losing accreditation.
No, I get that. I'm just wondering why, if it was just announced, last week, that'd be bad if NEIC thought they were going to get legislatures to pass this thing in 9 months. That'd be ridiculous, right?
I understand, Chair and members. They do give states time, and then eventually they kind of have the carrot and the stick kind of approach.
That's fine. Well, if you don't know, you don't know. That's fine. Any other questions for Mr. Kelly or Representative Elkins? None. Okay. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Article 4? Oh, Mr. Finewalks, welcome. And James Groats. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Finewalks.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for the opportunity. I will do my best to limit my comments to Article 4, and I'm sure if I stray, you will correct me. So, for the record, my name is David Finewalks. I reside in the city of St. Paul. I'm an attorney. I have some experience in issues related to health care and tangentially in health care insurance, and a great deal of this bill deals with health care insurance. I want to draw your attention to Article 4, Subdivision 5. Documents, materials, and other information, including the CGAD in possession or control of the department that are obtained by, created by, or disclosed to the commissioner or any other person under this section, are recognized by this state as being confidential, protected, non-public, and containing trade secrets. Those documents, materials, or other information are classified as confidential, protected, non-public, or both, are not subject to subpoena, and are not subject to discovery or admissible in evidence in any private action. Now, the way this is written, it would also apply to the operation of the state's publicly funded health care programs, Medicaid, MinnesotaCare, and the like. All of the money that these companies make and have in reserves comes from these sources, these publicly funded taxpayer programs. And to make this information non-public, confidential, non-admissible, and non-available would cut against actually a law which you, Mr. Chairman, I think were the principal advocate of some years ago after the Timberjay case, which says that when the state hires vendors, the information held by vendors who conduct the state's functions should be available to the public. Now, DHS has never ruled on the issue of trade secretness for these programs. The existing Minnesota law doesn't, in fact, declare these things to be trade secret. And with all due respect, you today should not do this and extend this concept to public programs, because if you have the least concern about nonprofit to for-profit conversion or the taking of massive reserve accounts across state lines or to other companies, you are about to close the door to any chance of stopping it, examining it, or dealing with it, and that is a most serious issue. You don't need to take my word for it. Some years ago, and I will be happy to leave you a copy of this, you can Google it for yourself, we did a study of capital reserve limits in Minnesota in March of 2014, and that study, which was done by an insurance consulting firm, DeWeese, found that, A, all the money in these reserve accounts came from profits obtained from working in public programs, and B, these public programs were cost-plus reimbursement programs, and reserves, in fact, were unnecessary. So to enact this today and close the door and prevent any future examination of these issues or where this money goes would, in my estimation, be a tragic mistake, and I would advise you not to do it, or at the very least, to explicitly state that nothing in this bill applies to health insurance company management of public programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Finewax. Hopefully, the department can respond to all that, because I'd be very interested in hearing the answer to that. But let's hear from Mr. Groats first, and we can entertain questions on everything else at the end. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Groats.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is James Groats. I'm from Edina, Minnesota. And I am speaking to you as a private individual, not on behalf of any organization. I have been licensed in the insurance business for over 40 years, and I have quite a bit of knowledge on this that I would like to enlighten you on. Going to Article 4, part of the problem I have in looking at this on corporate governance is the NAIC itself has a series of model laws. In fact, there's 212 model laws. And if you Google these and you try to go on their site and cross-reference that to the sections of the bill, you can't tell which model law this is from. And that's because in the handouts in the back or any place else, I can't find anything that maps out these sections in this bill to their specific NAIC model law, so that as an insurance professional, I can read it to make certain everybody's honest here. They're not there. They're simply not there. And, you know, there are also sections, for example, MDL 10, talking about reserves, and we're not adopting those. So why is it we're picking and choosing on which model law sections we're going on? And with regard to data practices, there is something that all of you should understand, because there's only a few of us that know about it. These laws that we're going to pass, they are governed by a series of NAIC manuals. These manuals, if laid, stood up side by side, are over 3 feet in width. That's a lot of law, a lot of rules, regulations, and a lot of law. There's only one copy of those manuals in this entire state that the public can use. And it's not at any law library, it's not at any public library, it's up at the Department of Commerce. And if you go up there to use those manuals, they're going to tell you, oh, we can't give you a photocopy of those pages because it's copyrighted material. And therefore, the public has no chance of really getting into this. It's very, very difficult. And if you want to get into it, you are free to spend $2,500 a year to buy a set of manuals. So there's a lot of this here that is unclear to me, and there are also sections in the bill that don't belong here. I am appalled as a senior that we've got 11 pages in this bill regarding us, no hearings, no public information meetings, no nothing, and yet we're also up at this body talking about elder abuse. Thank you, and if anyone has any questions, I'll take those.
I have one question, Mr. Groats. Now, I don't know the path that this followed in other committees. Maybe you can tell me, Representative Elkins, what other committees have you been through?
This is a Commerce Committee bill.
So it came before the Commerce Committee?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Groats or Mr. Finewicks, did you see it when it came up in Commerce? Did you
no,
speak to it?
It came up last minute, and I didn't see it, and anyone else that's watching for me did not see it.
Okay. Why don't we do this? I'd like to hear from, I mean, there is probably a dozen different issues that were brought up that probably should be spoken to by Commerce, and let's see what they have to say about it. Are there any other questions folks have until they answer? Let's hear from Commerce first, and then the other questions people may have.
Mr. Chair, I would just observe that this article deals strictly with corporate governance, this chapter. So the data at issue is mostly discussing corporate governance. It's not operating statistics or anything like that.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner from the Commerce Department. Let me just try to tick through, and please remind me if I've missed one of the steps. So just from an earlier comment, Mr. Chair, to your question, the NAIC, I think, first passed the Corporate Governance Model Act in 2014, so states have been passing it through that. The urgency to pass it this legislative session stems from, as Mr. Kelly indicated, the January 1, 2020 deadline for this to become an accreditation standard through the NAIC accreditation process. And I would echo his comments not just about its impact to the department, but its impact on domestic insurance companies for whom the department is the primary regulator, to the extent that the department would not be able to perform examinations of domestic insurers that would potentially subject them to examination, by all other state regulators in which they operate, which would be a significant burden compared to other states' regulatory regimes. Mr. Chairman, I think there may be some confusion. I think the language in Article 4, Subdivision 5, as Mr. Kelly indicated again, is the same language as we have in the ORSA Model Act, which we passed a couple of years ago, as well as the Holding Company Model Act. And so I think most of the health insurance companies in the state are part of a holding company, and so would be subject to those provisions. And again, this is the same language would already apply to those companies today. So the concern about HMO conversion, I understand the point that the Commerce Department is not the primary regulator of HMOs in the state. The Department of Health is. And so I think that and there is some legislation moving in the HHS omnibus bill that addresses that topic in more detail.
Well, Mr. Brickwitty, if I can ask you, that legislation doesn't pass, the data necessary to conduct any type of legislative oversight of that information would fall under Article 4, right?
Mr. Chairman, I think the data that the department would collect as part of the Corporate Governance Act would not necessarily be the financial data in full that either the Department of Health or the Attorney General's office in their review of those HMO conversion transactions would need to analyze. And again, I'm a little bit far afield from my work stream because, again, we are not the primary regulator of HMOs, so I think we would need to get the Department of Health to give you a little bit more information.
Well, I understand that. I mean, the Attorney General's office could get what they need to through subpoenas or administrative subpoenas, or deuces take them or whatever. That's up to him. But if we're going to craft anything on that, I mean, you know, we'd have to get 2/3 to issue subpoenas by this committee to get that info, and that's a problem. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And Mr. Chairman, understanding, and I think they would likely still be able to obtain that data under the provisions of the proposal that are moving through the HHS omnibus bill. I think the concern that was raised there stems from a change that was made in 2017. Allowing the existence of for-profit HMOs in the state for the first time. And so there's a concern that the moratorium on conversion transactions is set to expire, I think, at the end of this year. And so that's why there's activity on that front legislatively elsewhere this session.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think I may have missed my train of thought there. So I will perhaps leave it there and see if there are questions from members.
Questions from members? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brickwitty, you testified that this information wouldn't necessarily contain financial information, but that's kind of vague, wouldn't necessarily. If you could clarify exactly maybe the sections of the bill that outline exactly what would be shared.
Certainly. Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, I think if you refer back to the previous subdivision beginning on line 14.7, the contents of the disclosure that is required to be filed with the department under the bill are listed there, running through the balance of page 14, all of page 15, all of page 16, and through the top 10 lines of page 17. So those are the elements of the report that would be coming to the department, and then it would be treated with the data practices treatment in the confidentiality section in subdivision 5.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I notice Mr. Hopkins isn't here. I don't know if any of the other House research could say whether or not financial information is included in that.
Ms. Mullen?
Chair and members, what I see on page 14 is looking at corporate governance structures, policies, and practices. If you're familiar with business documents that are normally crafted that are related to the structure of it, those don't necessarily have any specific financial information, but may indicate things related to how they handle their finances, but they're related more to the structure and the policies of the overall business organization.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have another question. So this was presented to us that this has to be passed because this, if we don't pass this, NEIC yanks their accreditation. But is that all this is? Was there anyone else that came to you? I mean, is this strictly language that you need in order to be accredited with NAIC?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the contents of the bill include several NAIC Model Act accreditation standards. So, yes, I think we frequently have to translate from the NEIC Model Act into Minnesotan, if you will, on these data practices provisions because of the uniqueness of Chapter 13, which oftentimes actually applies a higher standard of confidentiality in existing law than the NEIC contemplates in its Model Act process.
Well, let me ask it this way. What provisions are in this bill that were asked for from the insurance industry or any representative from the insurance industry?
Article 5, actually, so the first four articles are related to NAIC requirements. Article 5 is actually another federal conformance issue due to the federal MACRA Health Care Insurance Act. And Article 5, to which this provision doesn't apply, would enable Minnesota health care insurers to offer replacement plans for the Medicare cost plans that are going away.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add that provision, and thank you to Representative Elkins for the reminder, those provisions were also contained in the department's policy bill and was part of the governor's proposal this year.
Okay. Other questions? Let me ask you this. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on this? Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I'm reading or looking at the verbiage here, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this pretty complex conversation that we're having here. And as I'm reading page 14 and 15, I just want to make sure I understand. So this information is going to be provided to the Department of Commerce? And if okay, so that was a yes. And then among the information that will be included would be as I'm reading on page 15, for example, 15.3, I think it was, how an appropriate amount of, nope, it's 15.1, I think, how the qualifications, expertise, and experience of each board member meet the needs of the insurer or insurance group, and this is in relation to the board, right? So this is just one example that catches my eye as this conversation was going, but is it my understanding with reading this language that this puts the Department of Commerce in a position where they are going to be reviewing the qualifications, expertise, and experience of each board member, and if the Department of Commerce deems it not necessary that they have an opinion on who can or cannot be on the board?
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, excellent question. I think the department is in that position now through our examination oversight of insurance companies that are domestic insurance companies here in Minnesota. I think the change in the law is clarifying with more specificity what would be in this report and the frequency with which the department would be receiving that information from insurance companies. As Mr. Kelly indicated earlier, we typically receive similar information from insurers during our regular exam cycle. The process that would be put in place here by passing this Model Act would have that come as part of a normal report. So we would be receiving that that information on a more frequent basis.
Okay. So here's what I'll say, Representative Elkins, and the committee. This is a bill that's very important to the Department of Commerce. I get that. That's been made clear. But I am really not happy about the committee being put in this position. This is a really complicated bill. And we need, honestly, more time to digest some of the consequences of it. And I don't, these questions, a lot of, we could ask, be asking a lot of other questions about this that we can't, because we can't wrap our head around it. I feel like Indiana Jones climbing out of that pit and turning around him and seeing that ball coming down behind him. Okay, so he has to go chucking for the edge of the cave and then dive out. Okay, and that's the position we're in right now, because, oh, if we don't do this, you guys don't get accredited, and, you know, the sky falls and that business. So I think that the concerns that were brought up by Mr. Finewax and Mr. Groats, I want some more answers around the edges of those. I honestly do. But I don't think many people on the committee are in a position to ask it right now. So I'm going to vote for it, but I don't like how this went down at all. And I would like more time, but you guys need it, so I'm going to vote for it. But I'll just put folks on notice for that. And I hope to God that we don't find something else out a year from now that this is going on because of the action that we took in this committee that we didn't have enough information about. But Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a procedural question. You and I both serve on the Commerce Committee. And, you know, the member of the public said this was not noticed, I'm sure not noticed 3 days. And I'm just going to ask the author, how many days' notice was this bill given before it was heard?
I'm positive that it met the three-day requirement.
Representative O'Neill.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it did. I think we need to be mindful of that because, you know, obviously Commerce doesn't have the depth to go into the depth that we're doing here. They have a different issue area that they deal with. But this is a pretty big bill with pretty large consequences. And, you know, we are in a terrible position, Mr. Chair. And it definitely needs more vetting and it needs more public notice. It was, I mean, if you look at the bill itself, it was only introduced on March 4th. It was heard on March 20th. And I don't recall when it was noticed, but I don't think it was 3 days. We kind of ran into a crunch time, as you know, in Commerce, of things being added quickly. So I take issue, as you do, with how this was noticed and how the public hasn't had enough time to weigh in. And you're right. I don't know that we've had enough time to digest this, to actually ask and vet this properly. So, you know, I know you want to move this forward. That's unfortunate that we don't have more time to really delve into this and maybe take it up next session. I realize that's probably not an option, but sure would have been nice to have this before beginning of March to digest.
Yeah, well, I understand that, Representative O'Neill. Part of this is, you know, transition of administration. Stuff gets left on people's desks, and, you know, it's mid-February before people find out, wait a second, what? This was supposed to be introduced? And that's happened with both parties' transition of administration. I've seen it happen. So I don't want to get too much into that, but it does put us in a really bad position, because at the end of the day, we vote this through, and, you know, it's on us if there's something wrong with it. So anyway, I think we're going to move to a vote on this, but I just wanted to register my reservations that you know, can we make the motion without recommendation? Can we modify the motion without recommendation and refer it and still meets the deadline that they need? That's going to be, who made the motion? Representative Constantine, would you be willing to amend your motion to no recommendation and recommend that it be re-referred to the General Register And then hopefully some questions can be answered for members between now and any time this thing goes on the calendar for the day. Is that good with you, Representative Elkins?
Yes, I mean, this bill was originally to be authored by Chair Halverson, and she had the ownership of the bill transferred to me, thinking probably that this would be an easy one and would be good practice for a new member.
Oh, it's good practice. I mean, she was right about that.
It has been good practice, yes. I've learned a lot of things from this moving this bill forward, but I would just say that, you know, the bill was heard in Commerce. None of these issues were raised in Commerce, and the issues that are being raised are largely issues that under Commerce's purview. And I would just again observe that this provision is on one of the five articles of the bill. It's a section that deals strictly with corporate governance structure, so it really isn't calling for the reporting of any of the kind of financial data that would be kind of the subject of the testifier's concerns.
Understood. Thank you, Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to thank the testifiers that came up and brought it to our attention and point out that sometimes having a citizen come up and raise concern really does help.
Thank you, Chair Considine. I've learned to trust a lot of what those two guys have to say. They've been right on the mark with a lot of the concerns that we've seen in health care and insurance and HMOs, this is one of those things that might not have been spotted had they not been on top of it. So Chair Considine withdraws his motion and makes the motion that this be recommended to be referred to the General Register without recommendation. Is that correct, Chair Considine?
That is correct.
All in favor say aye. 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 All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
Representative Dean. Of Dean's motion on House File 1146 is that it be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Who makes that motion? Representative Cantrell makes that motion. Okay, go ahead to your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I believe this is coming before the committee because of Subdivision 4, the pilot program data.
I guess specifically, Representative Dean, we're looking at lines 2.10 to 2.28.
That is correct, and Mr. Chair, I don't think that this is quite as complicated as the last bill that you are all considering.
We'll see.
So within the subdivision, it pretty much states that the identifying classification of participants' data is non-public data, or the private data for individuals is non-public. I have Mr. Buckeye from Department of Transportation that has worked on previous projects will probably be working on this project moving forward, and we're available to answer any questions. I'll just remind members that individuals that are participating in this program are doing it on a volunteer basis. This isn't anything that we as a state are imposing upon them to participate in the pilot project. We all know that the projections for gas tax revenues are going to be changing as cars become more and more efficient, and we need to develop a system that it doesn't depend purely on gas tax, and this is based on a mileage-based user fee. Some states have moved towards this, and I think it's time that we as a state begin to investigate and consider what that might look like for us in the future. So with that, I can turn it over to Mr. Buckeye, and if he can be brief about the work that's been done and the work that's hopefully being done, and then we will open up to questions to members.
Thank you, Mr. Buckeye. Go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ken Buckeye. I'm a program manager with the Minnesota Department of Transportation in the Office of Finance. As Mr. Dean has mentioned, I have worked in the past on mileage-based user fee demonstrations that we have done in Minnesota. And one of the things that we're recognizing is the convergence of shared mobility with automated vehicles and electric vehicles. And so we take this very seriously. We think transportation is going to be very different in the future. And with regard to the provisions of Subdivision 4 in the pilot program and data security, we recognize that data privacy and security are one of the critical issues surrounding the concept of mileage-based fees, and and research and opinions around the country support that understanding. And we believe it's enormously important to create safeguards to protect personally identifiable information. Minnesota's proposal for the mileage-based user fee pilot includes a partnership with car share providers and aims to ensure privacy protection through the process of aggregation of trip data and reporting that data from a central source, that being the car share provider. By working with these shared mobility providers, no personally identifiable information is exchanged, and the safeguarding of the motorist's account is ensured by both that provider and MnDOT as well. For the mileage-based user fee pilot, the point of collection lies with that shared mobility provider. As such, only aggregated vehicle-specific data will be needed, and no information relative to the existing customer base is required. Privacy protection, data sharing, and any data reuse agreements will be in place with the shared mobility provider and their customers. Minnesota does not require or request any specific data to assess the mileage-based user fee. Minnesota recognizes that the privacy protection and security of this data are bottom-line issues that cannot be compromised. And so we aim to create a mileage-based user fee protocol model that ensures this privacy and at the same time does not permit evasion. As such, we also recognize that there's a need for preserving records for a period of time for the purposes of auditing transactions and reconciling with the motor fuel tax. This is a baseline assumption laid out by our partners at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. We have already spent time with car share providers with discussions focused around how the mileage-based user fee pilot can protect the privacy of their subscribers. This pilot will use shared mobility as a model platform to test mileage-based user fees and build a knowledge base from that experience. That platform, or something similar to it, is becoming standard for manufacturers. And as that platform gains a larger foothold with manufacturers, the transition from maturing of mileage-based user fees is more easily enabled in a safe and a secure manner. And with that, I want to thank you for the opportunity, and I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Buckeye. Questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm confused because I thought we already have a pilot project, because I have participants in Wright County that participated in something, and I thought this was a pilot program for this. Don't we have this already?
Mr. Buckeye.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. We completed that early demonstration in 2013. So that the learning from that demonstration is helping to inform a new proposal that is being that was offered by the Federal Highway Administration under Section 620 of the FAST Act. They've incentivized states to take their pilot information, the work that they've completed, and take it to the next step to advance the notion.
Representative O'Neill.
So you have done a pilot, someone's done a pilot, and that information is out there, but how is this different from the initial pilot that was already done and completed in 2013?
Mr. Buckeye.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, this pilot is quite a bit different in that under that project, we outfitted drivers with a smartphone device that collected information that was then aggregated, was shared with the department, and mileage was calculated, and charge was then assessed on the drivers. Under this pilot that we're talking about today, I think ensures a far greater level of privacy protection, in that none of that information will come directly from the driver. It will come from an aggregated source, being the use of that vehicle, of a specific vehicle under the car share model. So it's quite a bit different pilot, addressing a lot of the issues that we think that we uncovered with that earlier pilot.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it different in scope? I don't recall exactly how many, but it seems like it was more in the dozens of folks in the initial pilot, and what is the scope of this? And I'm assuming then the data practices and privacy were not implemented in the first pilot. Would that be accurate, since now you've included that, or did you actually have data provisions and protections at that time as well?
Mr. Booker.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. We did have data protections in place at that time. That initial pilot was enrolled, I think, about 500 drivers. This pilot, we hope to partner with two car share providers in the Twin Cities metro area, and ultimately possibly thousands of drivers that are subscribers to that car share.
Do you have a final question, Representative O'Neill?
Yeah, just a final comment really quick. Just it's incredibly important that we're protecting that data then if we're expanding it so much. And I'm not sure why we need a second study, a pilot study, if we've already gotten one. But you know, at least there's privacy protections clearly spelled out. So I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just can't miss this opportunity to say that last year, the year before, under Republican leadership, we did finance another way. We did find another way of financing roads and bridges without collecting anybody's data, and that was through the auto parts tax. But I do have some questions regarding this particular bill and in previous ones. So you stated, Mr. Buckeye, that that you still do you still have the data from the previous pilot programs that you did?
Oh, Mr. Buckeye.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that data no longer exists, although the summary of that data does exist. Okay. So there is no personal identifiable information that's reserved.
Okay, thank you. And,
Mr. Scott?
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And how long do you anticipate one of the things that we try to do in this committee is put a length of time on how long data can be kept and stored. And so how long, I don't see that outlined in this bill. Is that something, Representative Dean, that you'd be open to putting a specific date or a number of months or years that you plan on keeping this data?
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, I'm certainly open to consideration of something like that. I don't think this is data that would need to be used or stored for long periods of time. I mean, in the end, the goal is the way in which we fund our roads is got to change. I mean, and we can do it one of many, many ways. And, you know, this pilot project is not only going to be within us, but partnering with other states, seeing what other states are doing. I'm actually from the mind that we could have people in the metro area going through one method of mileage-based user fee, whereas people that live in low-density areas may be going through another method. I mean, ideally, we would have a all-encompassing method for ease, but I think there's some opportunities to be respectful of individuals that travel a half a mile to a grocery store versus those that travel 20 miles to a grocery store.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering if Mr. Buckeye has an opinion on how long the data should be kept.
Mr. Buckeye.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think part of the learning from this project will be to understand how long it's necessary. I referred to the notion that Department of Revenue wants to be able to audit the data that's collected to make sure that mileage is accurate and make sure that the reconciliation with the motor fuel tax is accomplished. I suspect that it probably wouldn't need to be retained more than 6 months or less.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would that be something that your agency would be open to putting in this bill, like an exact date for that storage of data?
Mr. Booker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we would be.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, why would data be available for law enforcement to use with a search warrant? And this can go to either the bill author or the testifier.
Either one. I'll take it.
Dean. Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, this provision, I believe, was added possibly at the request of law enforcement. I know that, you know, the whole idea is ultimately we hope that we're not collecting that personal data, So when it looks at issues related to probable cause warrants, that it might be relative to larger issues than just that single particular individual's information.
Well,
Mr. Chair, that gives me a little bit of concern that they would have access to it at all. I mean, there's some comfort in knowing that they have to have a search warrant, but I don't know why, if somebody's volunteering to be in a program like this, why we would allow law enforcement to have access to it. Maybe there are valid reasons. So the next question then would be, would this data be available for law enforcement for those who fall into the driver's license for all proposal, House File 1500, which greatly limits the sharing of any of this documentation on undocumented residents' data?
Representative.
Mr. Chair, I believe that if there was an individual with driver's license for all that participated in this pilot program, that whatever data was available through the driver's license registration, be it a real ID or non-compliant ID, if that information was used as part of this pilot program, I believe with the probable cause search warrant, it would be available. But again, the intent of the pilot program is not to collect the data on those individuals. It's actually to collect the data on the usage of the vehicle.
Chair Scott,
Mr. Chair, question. Thank you. Well, the problem with collecting this kind of data is it gives you a location. So if they wanted to go back and go through the data, they could find that, and they could determine where somebody's location was. So I've never liked these kind of pilot programs for that reason, because it tracks people. And I'm surprised, Mr. Representative Dean, that you're carrying this bill, because I thought you were kind of on the same page with me on that issue. But anyway, thank you for allowing me the line of questioning, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a series of questions myself. But to Representative Scott's question, I had not thought of that. But when HF 1500 came through this committee, part of the line of questioning to Representative Winkler was, it was very clear that there's verbiage in that bill that says information in that database is expressly prohibited from being shared with law enforcement. And so if somebody in that database with that driver's license participates in this program, and I'm seeing here that data in this program would be the on line 2.14 is names of participants' contact information, then there would be a conflict, because that bill says expressly prohibited from sharing with law enforcement. This one says it is expressly permitted to share with law enforcement. So which one would win?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually was not in the committee hearing on 15. As a matter of fact, I haven't been in any committees that bill has come through, so I can't speak specifically to what Representative Winkler testified relative to that bill. I believe that your issue around what the information that could be part of this pilot project that is collected, if that information was strictly prohibited in another thing, I would assume that it would be then strictly prohibited from not being collected as part of this program. So, you speak to contradictions, and you've been here long enough to know that there are many contradictions within some of our laws, and there are certain types of levels of legislation or statutes that supersede other levels of statutes and laws.
Hold on a second, Representative Dean. Mary Mullen's got an answer for this. Mitt Mullen has an answer for this.
Chair and members, my understanding of House File 1500 is that it restricts data sharing related to the Department of Public Safety, and this bill is related, the data retention and collection is related to the Department of Transportation. So I believe they're two different agencies, and the data protection is related to two different sets of data collected by those agencies.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my recollection is that the language in that bill said sharing information with law enforcement, local, state, federal. And this references law enforcement and the sharing. So I think there would be. It's not departments. It's law enforcement. Okay, but to my other questions here. When I am looking at lines 2.14 through 2.20, And I'm looking at, well, let's look at 2.15, the word application there. So the and data contained in any applications to participate in the program. And just point of clarification, is that an app, like on a mobile phone, or is that an application that a person is filling out and submitting to become a participant?
Who wants to answer that?
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Buckeye.
Go ahead, Mr. Buckeye.
Mr. Chair, Representative. My interpretation would be that it refers to the application that a participant would submit to be a ride share, a car sharing provider. Yes.
Mr. Lucero.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then when I'm looking at line 2.19, a participant's financial and credit data, am I reading this correct, that financial and credit data would be shared then, or would be part of the information transferred to the state?
Mr. Buckeye?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that that would refer to data that is not public data.
Absolutely.
That we would not share that data.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I'm reading, so this entire section, subdivision 4, is the information that would be included in this pilot program and would be collected, and it is this grouping of data that would be classified as non-public. That's correct. That's my reading.
Yes.
But I just want committee members to be aware that that part of the information that's going to be collected here is a person's financial and credit data. That is very alarming, extremely alarming. Then another question here is 2.20, a participant's road usage data. And I'm looking in the definition of term section, and maybe I missed it. What is the definition of road usage data? Is that simply miles driven? Or is road usage data more expansive, such as what Representative Dean had mentioned in terms of where a person's driving? If they're driving a half mile to a grocery store or 20 miles to a grocery store, does that include their destination, how fast they're going around curves, how hard they're braking, et cetera, et cetera? Or, again, is it just miles driven?
Mr. Buckeye.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the road usage data that we would gather would be aggregated data from the car share provider. That data could be aggregated in a number of different ways. For example, it could be that data would be travel during peak periods, which might imply that maybe that charge should be higher during peak periods. It might also indicate that travel occurred on an interstate highway, but it would be aggregated and it would not be assignable to any individual.
Representative Lucero, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that even makes it worse. So road usage data is many different data points in regards to use of the road. As you just mentioned, the time, the location, and many other aspects. But you're saying it's going to become summary data. I don't see anything in here that requires summary data. In fact, I see just the exact opposite. On line 2.21, it says, nothing in this section prohibits the production of summary data. But I don't, and I could be wrong, so please show me in here, if I am wrong, where it's requiring that it's summary data that's uploaded to the state.
Mr. Buckeye.
Mr. Chair, Representative. We need the summary data in order to do the calculation to actually reconcile that travel. So if the car share provider knows how many miles a particular vehicle was driven over the course of, say, a month, we need to know and through that summary data, they would provide to us the summary of those miles. And it could be in a variety of different formats. For example, it could be miles traveled in peak periods, as I said, or miles traveled on a particular roadway, but it would not be assignable to any individual. And that's the security, data security, personally identifiable information would not be associated with that summary data.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to pick up right where Mr. Representative Lucero left off on here, because this is troubling to me, because you keep saying rideshare. There's nothing in here that limits this to ride-sharing programs. Any individual can sign up on this. So we start with a ride-sharing program, and now you're talking about time of day usage, type of when you're on the road, which roads you're using, tracking not only the time, but you know, pretty much every element of this. This is only a half a step from telling me that it's going to cost me 40 cents a mile to drive my car on the road during rush hour and 5 cents if I decide to go get my groceries at midnight. You know, this is a backdoor of the government coming in and telling me, forcing me through taxation to use the roads when the government wants me to use the roads, as opposed to when it's convenient to me or when it fits my schedule. And I really find no comfort in the fact that there's a probable cause search warrant. I mean, there's a lot of other things that run through here that I would really like to see that language in, but what's the probable cause for tracking any citizen's movement around?
Mr. Buckeye.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The bottom line with this pilot is that it is a pilot. It's research and development. It's opening up and increasing our knowledge base about what are the avenues, what are the opportunities, what can we learn from collecting user fees in a different manner than we do right now. So it's not prescriptive. We're not saying that this is the way it will be. We're not trying to write the law. We're not trying, but we are open to certainly considering all the possibilities, and that's what this pilot is about.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So opening the possibilities, well, right now we already changed the price on the min pass lanes. We already changed the price on those. So this is dovetailing right into that. Now, if you're going to put this right into everybody's car, we have a system in place right now that we just don't have the political will to change the price of a gallon of gas tax. I get that. But if you want data privacy, that's the best. For somebody that's paid well over $1 million already in my lifetime in road user fees and taxes, well over $1 million, I absolutely find this abhorrent that we will even entertain something that could be used in the future to track our usage and manipulate when and how we will use the roads.
Thank you. I didn't hear a question there, so I'm going to move on to Representative Herr.
Save all your retorts for the end.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Dean. I see you chomping at the bit there. I'm not ignoring it. I am ignoring it, but Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dean, for bringing this forward. I always really appreciate the fact that as not new on this committee, that my colleagues across the aisle always do a really good job of, you know, looking at the data, because it is really important about what we're tracking, what we're collecting. But I did just want to also include that we talk quite a bit about that Bill 1500, and I know that there's concern because we're trying to protect certain people's data while making other people's and collecting other people's data. And unfortunately, I don't have exact data on what's going to support what I'm saying here, because undocumented immigrants generally do not like to participate in anything that collects their data. And so I know that there's some concern here, but because they don't like to be surveyed, I can't tell you that they won't participate in this type of program. But they're already concerned in their data being collected or participating in programs, which is why they have issues with the census or they have issues with registering to vote. And so I think that though we're concerned about this particular bill and this particular group, I do not believe, based on what I know of the populations that I work with, that they would participate in this type of program. And so I think that I appreciate the concern being brought up, but I just wanted to add that point back into there. And then the other thing is that we collect data all the time on demographics of people to understand food security, whether somebody's banked or unbanked, whether they have insurance or not, whether they have secure housing. And yet we don't push back on those types of data. And I look at this as the same type of research, that we're trying to understand the changes in our environment and how we operate, and that really getting the research we need in order to do this work is really important, right? Because otherwise, if we come and say, well, we shouldn't be using gas tax anymore, we have no data to support why that should happen. And then we say, well, where's the data? But we prevent the data from being collected. And so I just want to say that this is a really a tricky issue, right? What's the difference between collecting data around and then misusing it and collecting data so that we can really get in front of the changing environment that we're operating within? So I appreciate all the discussion on this today. I did just want to ask really quick that, you know, in addition to in this data and how it's being collected, if it's being this is only being used for research purposes, is that correct?
Representative Dean, yes or no?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yeah, I mean, this is...
That's good. Go ahead, Representative Hurd.
And just one follow-up then. Is this type of research, has this never been done before that we would be concerned about the data? That is there already been precedent, even in other areas in which we collect data for research purposes? Is this much different than those other types of research projects that we do or pilots that we've done within our own state and other states?
Mr. Buckeye?
Mr. Chair, Representative, these types of pilots have occurred in other states around the country, and it is not very different. Our approach is different in that I think our approach does provide more data privacy and security provisions than other pilots have. And the approach that we're taking is very intentional to address that question.
Thank you.
Representative, thank you. Okay, members, we have Representative Considine, Grossel, Johnson. We have two more bills on the calendar, and we have 17 minutes left. I can't tell what the clock says from here, but so keep that in mind. Representative Considine.
I'll keep it real brief then, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think that Representative Lucero and Representative Barr have made a very strong argument for why we need to increase the gas tax. Thank you. At some point, though, that will run out. Will become, and so I'm going to support the bill right now because of it limiting it just for the research purposes. But as we go forward, we need to make sure that we are safeguarding that data, and I agree with that. But as Representative Hurd pointed out, unless we actually find out what we're talking about, we can't make informed decisions. Thank you.
Representative
Grossel. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Representative Dean or Mr. Buckeye, and I'm looking at this, and for what you're wanting to collect the data for, I guess my question, former law enforcement officer, I've written plenty of search warrants to get whatever information I needed. Why are you asking for the participants' financial and credit data if you're trying to determine how much highway usage they have or they're doing? I mean, that's... Those are some things that you said are non-public, but the way it says in Part C down there is that if I can articulate probable cause for a search warrant under oath or affirmation, I can go get all of this stuff. And if I'm looking at somebody, it doesn't matter who it is, but I can get all of this information. I guess why would you want this information? Why would you want that in your possession? Other than what you need for the study.
Mr. Buckeye.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you make a good point in that that provision for participants' financial and credit data, it's not a request that we would make of the participants, but it may be a request that the car share company has to make in order to enroll the subscribers. So it's not something that we would pursue. But as a operating business, the car share companies may need to collect that information.
Mr. Grossel?
I think that should be left to the participant and that company. I mean, I don't think. If they're gonna lease a vehicle or do something else, then that should stay between them. That kind of information. We shouldn't be grabbing a hold of that because, like I said, I can go get it, all of it. And that's where I kind of take a step back and say, you know, as the state, we shouldn't be telling them, you will do this to be a participant in this program. If they want to participate in the program, they're going to jump through the hoops with whatever company they rent or lease a vehicle from. And if they can't, well, then, you know, they would be disqualified as a participant possibly. I mean, it takes the burden off of yourself, off of me, you know, and puts it just, you know, leave that portion between them.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Dean. I understand the need for this. As CAFE standards keep getting higher and higher, and forced by the federal government, we're still driving more, but we're using less gasoline, or about the same amount. We also have the issue, and I sort of wish Representative Garofalo was here, because I'd poke at him a little bit with his electric car. But that's the issue. We have more and more electric and hybrids coming on the market that do not use gasoline or very little gasoline. They're using our roads that those of us, and I just figured that out just myself, I'm paying around $700 a year in gas tax right now. That's coming down here and doing stuff in my district. That's not counting my wife's driving or my son's driving. That's my own. Those with those type of cars do not pay that. I think they have a $75 surcharge right now on a year in their license or their registration. So I can see why we need to do something like this, but I wish maybe you want to put this program more towards just the electric vehicles and pilot them, see how much they're driving. That's a whole totally different ballgame that we're looking at now than everybody. Now you're getting specific to a certain type of vehicle that does not pay gas tax right now.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 1146? Then seeing no other comments.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. Just thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. And that is, well, actually, there's two. Would the up in, I know it's not under this purview, but it says that there's going to be an advisory panel, and I'm just wondering if those meetings of the advisory panel and any data created from the advisory panel would be public, and would the advisory council be subject to open meeting laws? And then number two is, will the applicants for participation be giving a Tennyson warning outlining exactly what kind of data will be kept in this database, which includes their financial and credit data?
Mr. Buckeye, please answer to both those questions. Please be brief.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The data that we would share with the technical advisory panel would be that summary data. It would not be data on individual drivers. So there would be no revealing of any personal identifiable information. And with regard to the Tennyson warning, I think the Tennyson warning would be required for the participants to participate in this demonstration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just hope that you would add that to the bill so it's abundantly clear, Representative Dean. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cantrell's motion is that House File 1146 be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No. No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, I'll just remind you, you were going to give me a closing statement.
Oh, I was going to. Yeah. I was also going to ask for public testimony. Is there anyone who wants to?
No, you already did ask for public testimony. You got one of the two right.
I got the more important one. No, but clearly you won. I mean, you won the vote, so you could only have done yourself harm if you had said something. Okay? So.
Notice I'm leaving, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative O'Neill, House File 1349. Members, we've got like 11 minutes to do two bills, and the second bill is the salt applicator bill. So. Just keep that in mind. I tried to manage this as best I could, but there was just a lot of stuff. Representative O'Neill moves that House File 1349 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill. You also have author's amendment, the A19-350 amendment, to get the bill in the shape the author so desires. All in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Welcome, Representative O'Neill, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to talk about treatment courts a little bit. We hadn't had a day where we actually got to hear from the treatment courts. We have talked about them in the sense that they're very effective. They reduce recidivism and a few other things. And since we are so short on time, I'm going to cut my comments because I think you would much rather hear from the folks that I brought with me. I am flanked by Wright County, so I am so excited to have them, and I'll let them introduce themselves and what they've done in Wright County with their treatment court, sort of how they started, kind of where they're at now. The reason that they are also here is they are running out of their federal grant money, and so that is a conversation that will be a part of your budget decision as well. And the only other thing I'm going to say is when I was crafting this legislation in January and into February, we didn't know exactly what the Supreme Court was doing with treatment courts. We weren't quite sure about their funding methods and their the formula that they're using. And so some of that has been resolved as in yesterday. We finally got some of that information, which is wonderful. And I think that Janet Marshall could come and speak to that as well. But I wanted you to hear from Wright County as to how they're expanding out in greater Minnesota and how that works. And with that, I will turn it over to whoever wants to start. Judge Tandy wants to start.
Excellent. Your Honor, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Tenney. I'm one of the judges in the 10th Judicial District and one of the judges that presides in the Wright County Treatment Court. It's known as the TURN. I've brought with me today, and we're here at the invitation of Representative O'Neill, to discuss our experiences in establishing a treatment court. We're a relatively new treatment court, started the implementation in 2016, and we're fortunate to receive a federal grant. We hope that this body and the legislature supports the budget request from the judicial branch to continue funding the counties that are running out of the grant, and we are one of those five counties. I'm going to limit my comments to that because I know you're short on time. I'd introduce you to Darnell Bretthorst. She is our coordinator, and she has any information regarding the startup costs that we had. We had a lot of opportunities through the federal grant to have more than most, probably, I would say. But it's an example of the startup costs that we had. And I would also introduce to you Jared Forner. Jared is part of our treatment court steering committee that Representative Neal also is. He was also our first participant and our first graduate. So he can share his experience going through the process so it puts a face to this this very real and very, I'd say, successful program. So
thank you, Judge Tandy.
Thank you.
Who wants to
I can go.
Welcome.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having me. I am the coordinator of the Wright County Drug Court Program.
And can you state your name for the record, please?
Sure, Darnell Bretthorst.
Thank you.
And I have listed here what the startup costs were with regards to the Wright County Drug Court Program. It's a handout in your packet. Okay, and it's also a handout in your packet. So I have listed here when we received our implementation grant in 2016, it was a three-year grant expiring in September of this year. What it included were the cost of the coordinator salary and benefits, evaluator from Hamline University on a very part-time basis, drug testing supplies for all of our participants, copies, office supplies, things like that for our program, as well as computer programming and assistance that we needed with that, incentives for our participants, and all of these are part of our best practices. Annual team membership, we have a team of 10 members that are part of this program, and then our national training and conferences that the team needs to attend for best practice purposes. That dollar amount on an annual basis to start up this program was approximately $137,000, and that is what we received from the implementation grant. That's 3 years, so over 3 years is approximately $350,000 that we received. That will be going away this year. There were in-kind services that the Court Services Probation Department in Wright County and the County Commissioners supported that were not covered by the grant, which averaged approximately $115,000, and that included a probation officer position and other miscellaneous expenses that weren't covered. So as you can see, our budget will be cut significantly with the implementation grant leaving us.
Thank you, Ms. Bretthorst. Mr. Forner?
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Jared Forner, and I'm an addict in recovery. My journey started November 3rd, 2016, as the first participant in the Wright County Treatment court program. And I would like to share a little bit about this experience with you. In 2016, I was in active addiction. I was going nowhere fast, and I was hopelessly desperate for change. I think I already accepted that my disease would put me behind bars, so I gave up. I was mentally and emotionally unstable. November 3rd, 2016, I was accepted into the turn, and from there I started to grow. The first thing that happened to me was I learned how to be honest, and that was important to me because I could never tell the truth before. I learned how to be responsible for myself and my actions. I learned how to be accountable for myself and my actions. And the longer I was sober in this program, the better person, better father, and better son I became. The turn supported me and my fellow participants in all areas of our lives. Praise was given when deserved, and discipline or sanctions were there when there were struggles. They provided resources to all of us with unconditional support. The turn gave me an opportunity to look within myself and change versus locking me up and throwing away the key. My addiction is in remission right now due to the skills that I have learned. In my opinion, Minnesota is a recovery state, and I am grateful the funding was there for me. In addiction and alcoholism, there are a lot of disappointments and miracles, and today I am standing before you as one of the miracles. I am honored today for this opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Forner. It's to have you up here testifying on this is really important for all of us to hear you. Your success, we do a lot of stuff up here. We're never sure if it really makes a difference. But to hear that it makes a difference for you is very helpful for us. Thank you. Any other testifiers that you had, Representative O'Neill? No?
Yes, there's a couple other testifiers coming down.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Abner-Holden. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abner-Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Since you have so very little time, I just want to say that we wholly support treatment courts. We know that we need to reduce the number of people with serious mental illnesses in our jails and prisons. Diversion is certainly one way, but mental health courts are another, and it makes everyone safer to be able to treat the underlying cause. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Katie Allen. I'm an attorney at the Neighborhood Justice Center here in St. Paul. My office provides the defense counsel for all four treatment courts here in Ramsey County. I myself represent our participants in mental health court and drug court. I just wanted to say two things. One, I myself have seen a great shift in the clients that I work with. I'm in the jails almost every day during the week, and it used to be that folks were like, get me the least amount of time a prison I can get. I don't want to do this. I don't do well on probation. Send me back and let me do my time. Now, almost every single person I meet wants to do treatment courts. They want to get help. They're seeing their cousins, their brothers, their uncles, their family members in recovery and doing well, and that has become the goal now. The other thing that I wanted to say is in my 2 years that I've been in treatment courts, we save lives. There are sometimes literally, sometimes people with terrible addictions who I think, honest to God, would have otherwise died if they had not done and participated in the treatment court. Through my experience, I've seen folks be reunited with loved ones, get their children back, be able to bring home babies when they were never able to bring home a baby before. So these are, we make real impacts, we change lives, we save lives, and there are so many people that need the help, that want the help, that are willing to do the work, and we're at the point where we can't help everybody. There are more people that need the help than we can help, and so anything you folks can do to sort of support that cause, and we're willing to do the work if we have the resources.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 1349? I don't see anyone. Questions from members? Representative Grassel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, was this a program that was geared to be taken over by the state after the federal funding ran out, or?
Representative O'Neill.
That's an excellent question. So, yes, because it's still within the purview of the courts. And Janet Marshall is actually here if you want to hear it directly from the Supreme Court. But yes, I mean, the intention was to have this as a seed money for the new courts, that was the federal money, and actually in the court's plan, that's sort of the beginning phases, and then as they grow and are successful, then the state would take them over. This is very new. I mean, we're not talking about a whole lot of years in. And I actually have the bill to expand this across all of Minnesota. We're not quite there. We have 21 counties right now that don't have treatment courts. 4 are working on it. But 21 in totality do not have treatment courts of any kind. Now, we've done great work in the amount of time that we've allowed all of Minnesota to have a treatment court. We now have 61 treatment courts. And so you also have to understand we're talking about some of the highest risk offenders. These are not, you know, they have a little bit of an, they have high needs. These are high needs, high risk folks. So it's just like the testifier that came and said, I had given up. I just thought this was going to be my life, and I didn't. That's reflective across the spectrum of those that are in these treatment courts. I have actually sat on the bench with judges, I think it's been at least 7 times to Hennepin County, so I sat in 7 different treatment courts in Hennepin. I sat in 3 different treatment courts in Ramsey County, and I'm actually on the advisory council for Wright County and sat with them several times. This absolutely changes lives. And when the last testifier was talking about how it literally saved lives and changed life, I got goosebumps. Like, it just is so impactful. This is one of the best things that we could possibly do to change the trajectory of people's lives. So, yes, this is absolutely within the state's jurisdiction and responsibility to take over at this point.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to thank you, Representative O'Neill, for bringing this bill. And as a prosecutor, I haven't had any direct interaction. My work hasn't led me to any direct interaction with treatment courts, but I've heard nothing but great things from other practitioners really around the state about it. So just wanted to thank you, and I was glad to sign on to your bill.
Thank you. Seeing no other comments, then Chair lays over House File 1349. Oh, we need public. I did ask for public testimony. Yes, I did. Chair lays over House File 1349 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, and thank you to the testifiers for being here. Representative Fisher. Before we go to Chair Johnson, we are 1 minute past the time that we typically adjourn. We're going to keep going. It's my hope that we can get through this in 15 or 20 minutes. So, Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I have to apologize. We have a constituent in my office I have to go see on an important issue. But I want to bring up, I did some checking on the House File 2051. It was heard on Commerce on the 15th. But it was posted and added on the 14th with a 20-page DE amendment. So it did not get much time to be really heard.
Understood. Thank you, Chair Johnson. Representative Fisher's bill is House File 1502, and the motion on this is that it be re-referred to Ways and Means. Members, we're hearing this but what sections? We're hearing this just for the sections. There's a liability provision, and what else? Okay, maybe nonpartisan. Who's taking this, Ms. Mullen? Sorry.
Chair and members, this bill relates to the liability of the commercial salt applicator and the owner of the real property. The bulk of that can be found on page 2 in subdivision 3. The rest of the bill relates to how the salt applicator does their work and the retention of their records. So that's mostly what we're looking at.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. So the motion is that it be referred to Ways and Means. Who wants to make that motion?
I do.
Representative Considine makes the motion. Go ahead, Representative Fisher. There's no amendments, right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. I have no amendments. Thank you, Chair, Committee, for the opportunity to present. I know that we're very short on time. Basically, what the section that we're applying to on the liability would allow commercial salt applicators who follow best management practices that are certified by the state of Minnesota to have some limited liability protection as they go about in the practice. I do have several testifiers here, and I'd like just to move quickly to them, and then if there's questions.
Come on now. Introduce yourself for the record, and please begin your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Sue Nissen. I'm a master water steward, and I'm a member of Stop Oversalting. We are citizens that have been working on de-icer reduction in Minnesota and in our communities. We are the people that left these little teaspoons in your offices because this is the amount of chloride that permanently pollutes 5 gallons of our Minnesota fresh water in our lakes and surface waters. And we have been mostly concerned on our end with education about best practices in water. But I wanted to say to you today that our group has contacted at least 250 applicators and property owners, and we believe that the education and liability in this bill are a combination that will make a big change in the amounts of chloride that are going into our waters. We can't get it out, so it is really important. I would like to thank Representative Fisher for all the work, Representative Mueller and Jung for being authors on this bill. Please support House File. Thank you.
Thank you. Next testifiers, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Forrest Sear. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. I represent about 1,200 member businesses, many of whom do commercial snow and ice removal when they're not growing flowers in the summertime. Obviously, clean water is a big issue for us, as well as limited liability. I'm testifying in support today of the bill. I'm not aware of any opposition at the current moment for this bill. And we have been working with a large group of other supporters at other organizations that are concerned about liability as well as clean water, including Clean Water Action, Stop Oversalting, Boma Minneapolis, Conservation Minnesota, the Sierra Club, Audubon, and others that I'm sure I'm forgetting. I want to thank Representative Fisher. He's been a fantastic author on this, and we would really appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Mr. Carlson, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice and wanted to just point out briefly what our concerns about this bill have been, the condition that the bill is in, and why we don't oppose it. We spend an inordinate amount of time on this particular issue, and one of the problems that we've had is that the perception of liability is much greater than the actual risk of liability. Civil cases in Minnesota are down 50% in the last 10 years, 35% just in the last 5 years alone. The very businesses that are here that want this bill are more likely to sue each other in contract. We have about 6,500 contract cases in Minnesota among businesses than we have among people who are injured or personal injury cases, of which are about 2,500. We see that frequently where businesses are much more likely to litigate. We call that do as I say, not as I sue, because they are very active litigants in the courts. But the bill that you have before us appropriately lays out the rules of the Salty Road as it relates to their liability. And what this says, Madam or Mr. Chair and members, on Subdivision 3 on page 2, is that if they follow these rules and they do it correctly and they are trained, that they won't have liability unless they do something wrong, something negligent, and that's on 2.22, that causes an injury to one of their patrons. If they don't do anything wrong and they properly salt, they don't have liability. That's where the law needs to be. Minnesota does not provide immunity or gross negligence protection or any other kind of protection to private for-profit businesses anywhere in law. And we have wrestled over getting this language right to the condition that it's in right now. If you're negligent and you cause an injury, you should be accountable. Quite frankly, if you pollute the environment, you should be held accountable. That's a different story. That's not what we're fixing. But we want you to know that the perception of litigation is not the reality, and the language in the bill is appropriate in that it makes certain that if you are at fault, you will be held accountable, or you can be held accountable. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. What I heard is we have a very delicate Pax Romana on this, so let's move along and not screw it up, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Noting that, any questions? Okay, we have two. Is there anyone from the public who has not been heard who wishes to be heard on this bill? I don't see anyone. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, to the bill author, if someone isn't a certified applicator, so a business that just spreads their own ice or their own salt crystals out there to prevent people from slipping, what is their level of liability if they're not one of these certified folks?
Did you want to ask that of Mr. Carlson or Mr. Representative Fisher?
No, the bill's author. Please.
Okay, Representative Fisher.
First of all, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott. First of all, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not an expert on it, but from my understanding, the way the bill is written right now, it would only apply to people who are certified. If they're not certified, the current laws in place would take effect.
Okay, Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair and members, just to be even more clear on that point, and we added this provision and we did discuss it. If you look on 2.31 and 2.32, you will see that the liability of someone who is not certified is not judged by the standard of someone who is a certified trainer. So that this is a voluntary program. If you do it, great. If you don't, this is irrelevant to you. It's not evidentiary. It doesn't provide a duty on you. So.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just wanted to say thank you to Representative Fisher for bringing this bill and for working hard on it. I've got a city in my district who's worked on this issue separately. I also have a compromised lake due to salt, so I'm a supporter of this bill and happy that you're bringing it forward. Thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the bill author. Is my reading of Subdivision 3, the liability section, that it is your intent that the owner of commercial property or any real property could go through this process and become a certified applicant and therefore spread their own salt on their own properties and then be immune from liability?
Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero. It says certified applicator. It doesn't matter who it is. It's anybody who is certified, has gone through the program, and is following best management practices also and doing all the documentation that is required.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, and that's my reading as well. So then I just want to point out, and maybe there's a better way to write this, but when I look at the definition of owner on line 1.16, it's a person who owns or leases real estate and enters into. So if I'm the owner of the real estate and I go through the process to become certified, do I have to enter into a written agreement with myself in order to qualify under the definition of owner because of the word and there? I'm just pointing that out. Or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, I am not a lawyer, so I'm not too sure how that would apply. I would think that, and maybe one of the lawyers around here might.
Mr. Chair, I don't need an answer on that. I was just pointing that out.
Good. Yeah. Okay.
And then, Mr. Chair, then maybe it would be a question for any of the lawyers on the committee when looking at line 2.17. The liability section, so they would not be liable if the hazard is solely caused. So my question for any bill author, any lawyers, how often is it when there's a lawsuit of this nature that there isn't any contributing factor of any kind? In other words, how is it difficult to meet the solely caused threshold?
Well, Representative Lucero, the contributing factors are pled. So whether they're proved or not is a question for the folks who are trying to settle it of how likely do they think they can prove it. I can tell you that slip and falls, for example, are extremely difficult to win on in Minnesota. Like, Minnesota juries do not like slip and falls. I can tell you, I've had one. So, I mean, good luck. If people, you bring a Minnesota jury in, and they're like, oh, you slipped and fell on ice? Yeah, okay, bye. It's pretty much the deal. So, I don't know if that's helpful at all. But
okay, and then one last question, Mr. Chair. Looking at subdivision 7, line 3.17, am I reading this correct that a certified applicator would have to... they would have to submit a report on an annual basis by July 1st on the amounts and types of de-icers used in the previous year. So every instance, am I understanding correctly, every instance that I'm out there spreading this ice, I have to document all of this and upload this to the state or to the commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, yes, that is correct. I know we're starting to stray a little bit outside the liability area, but that's one of the requirements so that we can track what's happening in pollution and seeing if we're actually making improvements across the landscape.
Thank you. Representative Carlson, briefly.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, thank you. We've had many conversations about this bill, and I do appreciate the time and the shape of which your bill is in. I'm very familiar with the PCA program and the good it can do in terms of keeping chlorides out of our lakes and streams. Question, with regards to the certification itself, and I think this was part of our conversation, but just for the record, so if the owner of a company or the foreman receives the training, but yet they have other employees that are applying the application, is it just that person overseeing the work, or does everybody that's performing the services also have to be certified?
Representative Fisher.
Okay. And that one there, I might ask for a little help answering this one. In terms of the certified applicator, is anyone who is overseeing, from my understanding, making sure that they're best. So in other words, you can have somebody who's certified overseeing the people, and the ways you know that is because you're documenting how much de-icer that you're using across the property and how it's being spread. So you're going to have documentation showing what's going on.
Mr. Carlson.
Yeah.
This is Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, I think the answer to your question is on 2.15. The protection applies to the applicator himself who has gotten the training. That's who is protected, plus the owner who contracts with them. So it's the person who has the training and the knowledge that gets the protection.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, that good?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just to that point, hopefully some of that will then, that training that's taken place can be transferred to staff so that those good practices are maintained, because if it's not transferred to the people that are actually performing the work, the program can kind of fall apart. So I do support this. I know it's been a lot of work in progress. Hopefully it can stay in the form it's in and not be messed with, but that is something where if there's some further conversation in which to take place, I would welcome it. Thank you.
Representative Considine's motion is that House File 1502 be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, members. That's the last bill on our agenda. I appreciate your indulgence for going forward. Tomorrow we're doing the walkthrough, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, tomorrow we're doing the walkthrough of the omnibus bill. There being no other business before the committee is adjourned.